Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Here's what usually happens. The stock markets hit a hot streak. Corporate America goes on a buying binge. And with the Dow poking around at 13,000, what do you know? That's exactly what we got today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. Details at 888-944-LIST and angieslist.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us today. It's the 23rd of April. Since the markets closed last Friday afternoon, $127 billion in mergers and acquisitions have been announced. The biggest by far is British banking giant Barclays shelling out $91 billion for its Dutch rival ABN AMRO. The deal could bring a wave of mega bank mergers all across Europe. But before you say, so what? Why should a European bank deal matter over here? Do me a favor and take a listen to Sam Eaton.
One of the conditions in Barclays' bid for ABN AMRO was that the Dutch banking giant shed its Chicago-based unit, LaSalle Bank. A group of rival bidders led by Royal Bank of Scotland wanted to keep the LaSalle Bank as part of any ABN buyout. It may be too late for that now, since Bank of America has already snatched up the Chicago Bank for $21 billion. Banking consultant Bert Ely says that's a bargain.
Almost gives a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to really build a good, solid, broad presence in Chicago and throughout the Midwest.
Something Bank of America has been trying to do for some time. Through its merger with LaSalle, B of A will rocket to the top of the third-largest deposit market in the U.S. David Manning with the Community Bankers Association of Illinois says in the past, prohibitive regulations kept the big banks out of Chicago.
The result of that, we think, is positive. It's created a market that's more diversified in the Chicago area, and diversification has really resulted in a more competitive banking market.
That means Chicago consumers get higher payouts on deposits and cheaper loans. Manning says the LaSalle buyout isn't likely to change that, since Bank of America will only control 14% of the Chicago deposit market. He says the more worrying trend is a national one. Bank of America is getting dangerously close to the federal cap that limits the share of deposits any one bank can control. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Working our way down the merger lists, we come to AstraZeneca. The UK-based pharmaceutical company, Crestor's, its blockbuster cholesterol drug, is going to pay $15.5 billion for Metamune out of Maryland. Metamune makes the inhaled flu vaccine FluMist, and its shares ran a fever today. Investors will get a 21% premium on Friday's close, which is prompting some talk that the price offered was too high. Helen Palmer reports now from the Marketplace Health Desk at WGBH in Boston.
AstraZeneca's painting this deal as very positive. It points to MedImmune's revenue last year, $1.3 billion, its pipeline of drugs in development, and potential efficiency savings of $500 million a year. Andrew Casper, an analyst with the pharma newsletter The Pink Sheet, says MedImmune will also bring valuable expertise in biotech.
They're going to get all this capacity and experience that MedImmune has manufacturing biotechnology products.
Casper says big pharma companies want to get in on biotech drugs because they're so lucrative. They're harder to manufacture, so they command higher prices, and so far at least, there are no generic biologic drugs.
Because of that, you have relatively high-margin products where you're selling it to relatively few customers at very, very high prices.
Still, Casper and other analysts worry the high price AstraZeneca paid could dilute earnings.
It does help them. The question is this the right price to have been paid for that amount of help?
Miller Tabak analyst Les Funtleiter says it won't be clear whether this was too high a price for a few years. But paying such a high premium is risky.
In general, the higher the price, The higher the failure rate.
Still, one group breaking out the champagne today is MedImmune shareholders, like David Katz of Matrix Asset Advisors.
We think ultimately it'll be a good deal for AstraZeneca, but it's a great deal for shareholders today, and we think also it will be good for patients that use the MedImmune products.
Meantime, anyone else looking to buy a small biotech company should expect it to cost an arm and a leg. In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace.
Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson's not going to have to worry about his retirement. The secretary made tens, if not hundreds of millions while he was running Goldman Sachs. But he is kind of worried about the rest of us. Paulson said at a press conference today, both Medicare and Social Security need to be fixed. Trustees announced those programs should live a year longer than the lifespans estimated for them last year. Jeremy Hobson reports now from Washington.
To the trustees, today's numbers were cause for alarm. This is the second year in a row that they concluded the money needed to finance Medicare will top 45% of the program's expenditures. But now that Democrats control Congress, it may be even tougher for President Bush to find a solution. Even Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson admitted that Social Security and Medicare reform had seen better days.
I never thought it was going to be easy. I don't mean to sound naive. There was a time when I was a bit more optimistic than I am today.
Jim Horney at the Center on Budget Policy and Priorities was also looking closely at the report today.
We don't have a crisis in the sense that we have to do something today, whether that something makes sense or not. But we do have a very serious long-term problem.
The problem gets bigger next year when some of the nation's 78 million baby boomers turn 62 and can start collecting Social Security. Many here say fixing the entitlement programs probably won't happen until President Bush leaves office. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Woulda, coulda, shoulda. Investors are going to have to wait for Dow 13,000. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Boris Yeltsin first truly got the West's attention in August of 1991 when he jumped up on that tank in front of the Russian Parliament building. But it wasn't until January of the following year that he really turned communism upside down when he lifted 75 years of Soviet price controls. Yeltsin died today at the age of 76, and that shove that he gave Russians toward a market economy is still shaking itself out. Rajan Menon teaches international affairs at Lehigh University. Professor, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
A lot of the headlines today, sir, have pointed out that President Yeltsin introduced free market reforms to the Russian economy. But if you look around the Russian economy today with increasing state control over a number of key enterprises and the oligarchs in the Kremlin and in Moscow, what would your vote be on how things have turned out?
Well, Yeltsin no doubt laid the foundation in many ways for a market economy and a democratic system. But many of the ills that we see in the Russian economic and political system today, the increasing control by the state, corruption, cronyism, all of this can be traced back to Yeltsin. Now, the one difference, of course, is that whereas the Russian economy contracted severely under Yeltsin, especially after the currency crisis, under Putin, as you know, there have been year upon year of solid economic growth.
Why was it then that President Yeltsin wasn't able to do more for the Russian economy? Did he just go too fast with his reforms?
Yes, I think that was part of it. He believed that unleashing market forces would bring stability and prosperity. And when you have a system like the Soviet system, in which prices were set by the state, in which there was virtually no private property, and suddenly transform it, I think you have the foundations for a great deal of chaos, especially when the institutional requirements for a capitalist system, sanctity of contracts, transparency, and the like, were not yet in place.
Do you think we've come as far as we might in the Russian economy, or might things have been handled better?
Well, as far as the Russian economy today is concerned, we won't know how robust it is because we have not seen it in the Putin period performing with oil prices being very low. It is largely a hydrocarbon economy. Now, there are those who will say there's much more going on, true enough. But the hydrocarbon sector, oil and gas, accounts for so much of Russia's exports and its foreign revenues that we have to really ask ourselves, in the absence of sky-high oil prices, what might the Russian economy be like.
Let me get this back to President Yeltsin before I let you go. How much blame does he deserve for the state of the Russian economy today as it is influenced by politics?
Well, I think the oligarchs, the lack of transparency, the corruption, the cronyism, all of this, plus the enormous strides that Russia had to make given the contraction that occurred under Yeltsin, can be traced back to that period. Now, my point is not that all of these things Yeltsin created as an individual, but the Yeltsin system was shot through with these characteristics, and therefore, if you see them in Russia today, you can't see them in a vacuum because they have an antecedent, a past, if you will.
Rajan Menon is a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He's a fellow at the New America Foundation as well. Professor Menon, thanks very much for your time.
Hi, thank you.
They call them primary care doctors because that's what they do. Family practitioners and pediatricians spend a lot of time keeping us well. Studies show they're a pretty cost-effective part of the whole healthcare system. They don't make the salaries that fancy specialists do, and their numbers have been dropping as big managed care has become the norm. But Pat Loeb found one doctor who's made the switch back to a small practice. Really small.
Okay, Miss Berry.
Hello.
I'll just have a seat down there.
Dr. Gary Sito is his own receptionist. He answers his own phone calls. He schedules his own appointments and makes sure they're at least 30 minutes apart. He makes house calls. He sounds like a throwback, but in fact, he's on the cutting edge of a new trend, the micro practice. Here's how Dr. Sito explains it.
I want it to be like the iPod of medical practices. I mean, when you have an iPod, it just works, right? I mean, you know. So when a patient calls up, you know, what could be simpler than the doctor answering the phone?
Dr. Sito was inspired by Gordon Moore, a doctor who quit his big practice 6 years ago and wrote about starting a micro practice. Dr. Moore's account inspired a lot of physicians. Dr. Sito administers a web listing of solo practitioners. There are about 100 now. They're motivated by the same stress Dr. Sito was feeling in a big practice. 15 minutes a patient, the standard appointment time, was not enough.
When you first start out, you don't know that much. Mm-hmm. So maybe 15 minutes is enough time to go over all the things you can possibly go over. But as you learn more and know more to do, 15 minutes gets smaller and smaller.
Dr. Sito explains that insurance companies reimburse primary care doctors about $70 a visit. It doesn't matter how long a visit lasts or what the doctor does, the fee is the fee. Large practices with high overhead squeeze in as many patients as possible. They need a lot of reimbursements to cover their costs. That means shorter visits, and it creates a vicious cycle. Primary care becomes less attractive. Fewer doctors want to do it. Those who are left have to see more patients.
The United States healthcare system is heavy with specialists rather than primary care doctors, and it's getting worse because the lifestyle for primary care doctors is so awful.
The micro practice tries to overcome the problem of low reimbursements by lowering overhead. That's why Dr. Sito does everything himself. He's learned to give his own shots, something a nurse does in a big practice, and do his own billing. These are things that don't compromise patient care. In fact, patients seem to prefer the personal touch. Matt Berry is a patient. He says his medical care is better since he started seeing Dr. Sito.
My calf, I had been running.
Dr. Sito is a guy who, he knows you, he remembers what you were in for the last time, he calls you up after you've been there to follow up on things. When he says he'll check into something, he checks into it. You know, we kept saying, now we've kind of gotten used to the fact that he's the way he is, but we couldn't believe it in the beginning. We really could not believe it. I used to say to him, I don't believe that this is actually the case here. And he'll say, what time is good for you? The words that no doctor in America is allowed to say anymore, which is, what time is good for you?
When did it start hurting?
It started hurting while I was running a lot.
After 3 years as a solo practitioner, Dr. Sito has 725 patients, about as many as he feels he can handle right now. This year, he expects to show a profit for the first time, $20,000. It's a far cry from the $140,000 he made in a large practice, but he's achieved his goal.
I wanted to be able to practice the way I thought things should be done.
In Los Angeles, I'm Pat Loeb for Marketplace.
Coming up, a car with so much under the hood, it practically flies down the highway.
So truly, it's almost like the level of a private jet, or maybe even better than a private jet in some cases.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials fell 42 points today, a third of 1% to close at 12,919. The NASDAQ dipped 2 points, about a tenth percent, to finish at 2523. The S&P 500 declined 3 points, about a quarter percent, to end at 1480. The biggest deal in town was that Barclays ABN AMRO thing we told you about. ABN AMRO declined more than 2.25%. Barclays bobbed down 2.75%. Bank of America, which is buying ABN's LaSalle Bank, as Sam mentioned, slipped about 1%. AstraZeneca shot down more than 5% on news it's buying MedImmune. MedImmune made nearly 18% today. Still with health, Pfizer drooped about 2.33%. The world's biggest research-based pharmaceutical company got a downgrade and some negative comments from analysts. As crude oil prices pushed above $65 a barrel, there was concern over consumer spending. Walmart, the world's number one retailer, shed more than 1.5% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.65%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. And by the important new book, Speaking of Faith, by public radio host Krista Tippett, in bookstores everywhere now. Ever hear a song on Marketplace, but you just can't place it? Or maybe it's the first time you've heard it and you want to hear it again. Just click on the archive section of our website. We list the songs we play on every show in that day's rundown. There's even a link to the Public Radio Music Source, where you can buy the song and help fund public radio programming. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Tuesday. In New York, the Conference Board reports its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. In Washington, the House Education and Labor Committee discusses equal pay for men and women. And Shirley MacLaine celebrates her birthday. In this life, she is an actress and a writer, and she'll be 73. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. We could all use a little lift now and then, especially on a Monday. But women who might be inclined to use cosmetics to cover up their laugh lines ought to think hard before whipping out their wallets. Canadian researchers said today a chemical used in those products makes wrinkles disappear by damaging your skin cells, killing them eventually. In today's edition of The Lowdown, commentator Sandra Tsinglo tells us about her own brush with the more perfect face.
So a dear friend has begun selling beauty products for Arbonne International, a direct marketing company, which means to help her win her coveted white Mercedes, we should all be buying Arbonne products. For instance, with every $250 Arbonne purchase for just an extra $45, this $145 Nutriminci RE911-piece travel set, including, and I quote, eye cream, day cream, night cream, deep pore cleansing mask, facial scrub, hydrating wash, body serum, facial serum, toner, body wash, and body lotion, along with a baby orange puff and travel tote. Now, I'm a mother of small children who can barely remember where she left her car keys. Unless the travel tote comes with an intern, I'm going to be putting on night cream in the day and day cream in the night. And how good does my skin have to look anyway? I'm 45. Yes, the mirror suggests I look a bit wilted for the inner 32-year-old I always magically envision myself to be. Then again, do the math. You think, for almost 50,
I look pretty good. Plus, in my post-feminist marriage, I put in half the money, the parenting, and the poorly done housework. Unless my husband dutifully starts slathering on his fair share of creams and masks and washes, why should I? Sure, I could spend $1,000 a year on Arbonne products, another $1,000 Botoxing my forehead crease, it's preventative, and another $4,000 cutting, straightening, and coloring my hair. Many of my 40-something girlfriends have beauty regimes that literally cost this much, but if we live another 4 decades, what is that? A couple of $100,000 just to maintain? So I'm thinking, maybe I just sit it out for 20 years. Take a 2-decade-long moisturizer and toner sabbatical. Start up again when I'm 65. With those intrepid boomers leading the way, I'm sure by 2027, modern science will have invented some kind of zapper or peeler or stunner that can spray on an entirely new face. Perhaps shares. When Arbonne has that, I promise, I'll slap down that Visa card.
Humorist Sandra Tsinglo lives in Los Angeles.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
You can hear the music, you know what it means. It's time to take a look at your letters. We've been covering the growing scandal in the student loan market. Colleges and lenders have been in cahoots to deny students a fair borrowing market to pay for their educations. Tim Spence wrote to say he loves being a professor at Hollins College in Roanoke, Virginia.
But I don't make enough money as a teacher to pay a mortgage and to pay off my student loans. The private sector makes a lot of money off of my PhD and education in general, more than I have so far or probably ever will. Shouldn't the state be interested in an educated, debt-free citizenry?
Desiree Zamorano heard a conversation I had with Princeton economist Alan Blinder about free trade last week. Professor Blinder's changed his mind a little bit about whether free trade's always a good thing. And he told me that America ought to reform its education system to produce workers who can compete better in a global economy. Ms. Zamorano, a professor of education here in Los Angeles, as it happens, doesn't see it quite the same way.
Here's a radical thought for our schools. How about fostering creativity and critical thinking, synthesis, analysis, and evaluation? These are life skills, transferable across all industries and pursuits. Unfortunately, in American schools, achievement is narrowly defined by bubble and tests that feed an enormously wealthy and growing testing industry.
I was off for a couple of days last week, and while I was gone, Tess Viglin took a tour of her garden with flower expert and author Amy Stewart. Sue Rosenberg in Saratoga Springs, New York, says we might not have stopped long enough to smell all the flowers.
Pesticides may not add much to the dollar cost of a bunch of roses, but poisoned workers and polluted fields exact a high price in health care, lowered productivity, water treatment, you name it. When you tick off the reasons why a Mother's Day bouquet costs so much, don't forget to count the price of pollution and exploitation.
And don't forget to send us your comments. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. You know how you always hear retailers blame the weather for poor sales? Here's Detroit's variation on that theme. Today, General Motors Vice Chairman Bob Lutz said car sales have been hurt this month by the subprime mortgage crisis. Lutz said he doesn't know exactly how bad the numbers will be. Carmakers report April sales a week from tomorrow. Lexus, meanwhile, unveiled its new flagship luxury sedan today. It's not a car for everyone, not with a six-figure sticker price. But there's a reason all drivers should be interested in what it's got under the hood. Marketplace's Brett Neely reports.
The car is called the LS600HL. Fortunately, that's not the sexiest thing about it. Inside, there's luxury to spare.
We've covered the entire dashboard in this car with a hand-stitched leather so that basically the occupants are really surrounded in luxury.
Brian Bolane is a marketing manager for Lexus. He points out the car has an automatic parallel parking system. Impressive. So is the price. $104,000. That's before taxes, fees, and a pair of fuzzy dice on the rearview mirror. If you've got more cash to burn, try the executive option. It's got a reclining seat with footrest in the back and, as Brian Bolane explains, a built-in shiatsu massager.
It's almost like the level of a private jet, or maybe even better than a private jet in some cases.
Feeling guilty about all that pampering? Then wrap yourself in a virtuous cloak of green. The 600 is a gas-electric hybrid vehicle. Hello, carpool lane. It may also be one of the safest cars on the road.
Hey, Jeff, are we clear to come through?
Some friendly engineers from Lexus took me out for a spin to demonstrate. Just before we crashed into that wall of cardboard boxes, an alarm went off. The onboard radar and a bevy of cameras lets you know if you're getting too close to obstacles. The seatbelts automatically tighten to put you in a crash-ready position. The brakes and steering get supercharged so the driver can turn harder and brake faster. This Lexus is part of a growing fleet of luxury cars with highly advanced safety features on board. Paul Eisenstein's a longtime car critic and publisher of thecarconnection.com.
All the systems on the car, from your brakes to your engine to your transmission, even your shock absorbers, are all talking together and responding collectively in the event of an accident or a possible accident.
There's a high-tech arms race in the luxury car world to build the safest vehicle on the road, for those with big bucks to spend. Some new Mercedes models have systems that close windows and sunroofs before an accident. If your new Infiniti drifts out of its lane, the system gives you an audible warning. Future models will steer you back into your lane. So why did safety suddenly get so big for luxury car makers? Dave Alexander is a senior analyst for ABI Research.
There's not a lot that distinguishes performance. Safety is something else they can use to differentiate themselves.
But competition amongst car makers for well-heeled drivers has a trickle-down effect on the rest of us. For example, features like anti-lock brakes were an expensive option 20 years ago. Now they're practically standard. Don't be surprised if history repeats itself, says car critic Paul Eisenstein.
The rate of migration from top-end products down to the bottom is happening quicker and quicker, so that even Hyundai and Kia, the companies you generally think of as sort of the bottom of the automotive spectrum, are now heavily pitching all their safety hardware.
No one really knows when crash detection and other advanced safety technologies might become standard on mere mid-range vehicles. So for now, your choice is this. Buy a regular car, and most of them are pretty safe these days. Or if you're the cautious type, put off by high speed and hairpin turns, and you're rich enough, you could always spend $100,000 on something luxurious and safe, like the Lexus LS600LH. I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo has some company in his ongoing probe into questionable practices in the student loan industry. Cuomo announced today attorneys general from Missouri and Illinois have joined his investigation and that Washington University in St. Louis and DeVry University in Illinois will reimburse affected students. There will be a new college loan code of conduct that forbids kickbacks, too. Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy has promised hearings later this week. Senator Kennedy chairs the Senate Education Committee. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 42 points. That's about a third of 1%. The Nasdaq lost 2 points, about a tenth of 1%. The S&P 500 dropped 3 points. We'll call that one a quarter of 1%. Marketplace's producers include Jane Lindholm, Brett Neely, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time, parsing the culture of office gift giving.
I don't think it's a problem to give a gift to a person that is saying, I thought of you and the things you're interested in. When you cross the line into that personal gift, that lingerie, the colognes, that's a different kind of I thought of you.
Yes, yes it is. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong.
New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.